Welcome everybody to the show. Gideon, how's it going this week, man?
It's going good, man. I'm getting closer to beating Spider-Man 2. I'm about 80% of the way through. I was just checking trophies today. I think I'm almost 50% of the way to the platinum, so hoping to get that done by end of next week.
So you got the black suit and you're doing all the Venom stuff, right?
I just got to the Venom stuff.
Okay.
Like proper.
I don't want to spoil anything. What's the last thing you did?
And spoilers for listeners, of course, but the last thing I did, basically Harry got the symbiote back and then just straight up turned into Venom and started going on Rampage.
Right, and you played the part where you play as Venom.
I didn't do that whole part yet. I had to stop.
Okay. Yeah. That part is the sickest thing fucking
yeah.
ever when you play as Venom. You only get to do it for like 10 minutes, but you just go on an absolute rampage through Oscorp. It's totally awesome.
I'm so excited.
Yeah.
It's gotten a lot better, and I feel like my overall opinion has definitely increased after getting so far in the story. And I like the game a lot more. But I'll give full thoughts when I beat it.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, not to turn this into a Spider-Man podcast, but
yeah.
I think Kraven is much better as a villain as the game goes on. They don't significantly like explain why he's there in the beginning of the game. He's just there so like, because you need bad guys to fight, right? And Kraven has like a giant army of dudes and mechs and weird robot dogs and birds and things for you to fight, and that's cool. But they needed a guy that had an army, so you had like a lot of guys to fight, because like Venom and the Lizard weren't gonna do that, right? So for the first like third of the game, the whole reason for like anything bad happening is like kind of flimsy. But I think they really delivered on Kraven later in the game, and like his motivation for like he wants to be killed by somebody better than him. He doesn't want to just die of cancer.
Dude, and his boss fight was awesome. I really liked that boss fight.
Yeah. I feel like there was a lot of... I feel like I fought Kraven like 3 or 4 times or whatever.
Yeah.
Or I fought him like as Miles, and then I fought him as Peter. It was a lot of different stuff going on there. Awesome. Yeah, Neil, how's it going this week, man?
Back to work after spring break, so that's been a shock to the system.
Yeah, bummer.
Reintegrating Rhonda into my life has been
an
absolute joy.
Mm-hmm. Well, I do that every time I go home for a visit, too. I have to reintegrate Rhonda into my life as well. So, well, that's good. And so you're back at work. I said you were enjoying Stronghold, the game.
Enjoying is a word.
You're experiencing Stronghold.
Yeah. There are moments of enjoyment and there are moments of pure frustration.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. I can kind of understand that. I just got back from a long weekend in New York City where I walked like 42,000 steps in 3 days, and I still somehow managed to gain weight because you know, you eat giant bagel sandwiches for breakfast every morning, you finish off the day with some pizza and some beer and pastrami and dirty cart water hot dogs. I mean, you're just gonna gain some weight.
why are you glossing over the most important thing that happened to me?
Yes. Yes. Me and Grace got engaged, so that was fun.
I Grace got down on her knee on top of the Empire State Building.
Yeah, it was just like King Kong.
Yeah.
She picked me up in her hand and we sail off into
throw you.
Yeah.
Grace has unusually big hands.
Yeah. Well, she's sensitive about that. Yeah, thank you very much.
Yeah, congrats, dude.
It was cool. It couldn't have really worked out better. The thing I'm most happy about from New York, and Grace thought this was funny too, was getting stopped and asked for directions by locals who assumed I was a native, because look at me. So it was just like,
that's so funny. You're like, I belong here.
Yeah. No, it was funny. I was talking to Amari about what an underrated feeling it is to like be in a place where a bunch of other people look like you and you kind of like feel like you fit in a little more rather than being in like Minnesota and just surrounded by really tall blonde people all the time. But yeah, it was cool. It was funny. I actually talked to a coworker today who's similarly like, you know, let's just say European-y kind of features and like black hair. And she was like, the exact same thing happened to me when I was in New York, where people were like asking me for directions. It's just, of course, she's from Minnesota. So, yeah, so that was kind of fun. Anyway, I was really disappointed. The last time I picked a movie was Frost Nixon. And I felt it was a boring, lame pick. And it didn't have any teeth, and it didn't make for a particularly good conversation, because it was just kind of like a blanket good movie. So I decided to go in the complete opposite this direction and pick David Cronenberg, the second of the Weird Daves, with David Lynch.
David Lynch. Oh yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and picked Videodrome, which I didn't know anything about. Other than that, I'd heard the title, and people on 4chan always talk up how good this movie is, and I knew that obviously David Cronenberg is the thing he is known for more than anything else is like the body horror. Mm-hmm. And you know, I know that wigs Neil out, so I'm excited to hear his take on the movie. So yeah, my history was with this movie was just knowing the title and knowing that it had James Woods and Debbie Harry, and it was this 80s kind of thing, and you can kind of assume from the title it's going to be focused around like VHS and like video technology from the 80s or around that time, and knowing that it's David Cronenberg, some wacky shit is going to go down, right? So Gideon, did you have any history with this movie?
No, I similar to you, I'd always heard about it. I've heard about Cronenberg. I don't think I've really seen maybe any of his movies until now. I'd have to double check.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, does he have a son or something making movies now also?
I'll look it up.
I don't remember, but there was a something Crimes of the Future, I think.
Brandon Cronenberg.
Yeah, that might be him, but I could be wrong. But yeah, no, I had no history about it. I kind of have an aversion to body horror as well, so I thought this was going to be an interesting, test, I guess. I don't know. So, but yeah. Yeah, that's my experience.
Okay.
It.
Neil, had you heard of this movie before?
No, I'd heard the name Videodrome. I didn't know anything about it, except it was directed by David Cronenberg, who I only know, like, I've seen monsters just in other movies and media described as, like, Cronenbergian.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think I've seen anything by him previously. So this was all fresh to me.
Mm-hmm. Okay, brilliant. And so I guess we kind of start with that. So the synopsis is basically that James Woods' character is a owner-operator of a small-time cable television station in Toronto, and he's kind of on the lookout for more content that is going to be similarly extreme or like continue to draw his viewers in and more extreme. They want to show stuff that's more extreme than what's currently on. He is constantly pressuring the people he's getting the content from, hey, this is a little too soft, you know, we need something a little bit more edgy. And then he kind of comes across this broadcast out of Malaysia called Videodrome, which is like, what, you know, he thinks it's showing like really just realistic snuff imagery, but it, you know, obviously events transpire and it's a little darker than that. So it's him kind of going down the rabbit hole of trying to figure out exactly what this station is and what is Videodrome and all that. So I'll kind of give my top level thoughts, and then we can kind of go around and talk more deeply about any aspect of the movie you guys want to go into. I came out very mixed on this movie. I think from a plot perspective, it starts off strong, but elements are introduced in the middle of the movie where it's no longer clear that our hero is like, is he hallucinating or is this really happening? And I kind of feel that it's hard to get invested in a character or to feel like tension with the plot when I don't know if they're just going to pull the curtain back and be like, oh no, it was all a dream. You know, because they kind of do that a few times in the movie where they make you think something crazy happened. And then it didn't. And kind of from that moment on, you're kind of saying like, okay, you know, fool me once, shame on you. So plot good until about halfway through, and then I started to be like less interested in the plot. Characters are like fine in this movie. Nobody's like super interesting. Nobody gives like a bad performance, but there was nobody that was like really dying to learn more about, and you know, yada yada. So like the plot and the characters and the writing is all like serviceable, but not great. The real key to enjoying this movie, I think, is the visuals and the vibe and the soundtrack and the body horror and just kind of all the superficial elements. And if you can enjoy it on that level and just kind of be along for the ride of, wow, this is a really crazy thing, I think you can have a good time with it. As much as I would hesitate to call this like a watch with your buds movie, this would be like a great film in 40s movie, I think, Neil. But I don't think it's like, you know, this like Criterion worthy masterful thing. And one more thing before I shut up about it, I think that if, like many movies we've watched on this podcast, I think if I would have watched it at the time of release, I would have been more compelled by like the themes and the metaphors and like, oh, is television really rotting our minds? But now in the year 2024, I'm like, well, I grew up with a computer in my room, and I could go on Live Leak and watch people die in industrial lathe accidents anytime I wanted. Like, what, you know, the idea that I might have HBO or Cinemax on my TV isn't really that threatening in a world where I can just go on TikTok and type in industrial accident and see basically snuff films anytime I want. You know what I mean? Like, it just doesn't have that same power. I suppose on the other hand, you could say that it was like sort of prophetic and predicting that like humans kind of want this content in a weird sadistic kind of way. So, I mean, those are overall all my kind of thoughts. I would give it kind of a middling, like really middle of the road review.
Yeah, I gotta agree. Like, you're right. Like, the body horror eked me out, and you know, I was turned into a little girl for a little bit. Honestly, like, it wasn't even that bad. My body horror aversion is something that's a little different from this. So, yeah, it was gross, and you know, I cringed a little bit. But it was also like the special effects are the best part of this movie.
Oh yeah,
100%.
Yeah,
they're fantastic. I'd put them almost on the same playing field as The Thing.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, like, you know, like I couldn't tell you I can tell you two characters' names. Harlan, who I was like, oh man, here's Sam self insert again.
Yeah.
And then the admittedly great name Brian Oblivion.
That's that's like a perfect video game character name.
Yeah.
Yeah.
When they first had him in the panel show, I was like, I didn't know he was going to be a like strong supporting character. It was just like I just thought he was going to throw. I was like, oh my god! Like, you're just going to throw away the name Brian Oblivion?
Yeah.
Brian Oblivion would be like the guy you collect audio logs from in a BioShock game.
Yeah. Or like a really fucking awesome DJ at some underground rave. DJ Brian Oblivion.
I'm putting my claim on MC Brian Oblivion.
It's so good, man. Yeah, and I do want to shout him out while we're talking about him. The fact that he's so baller, he's like, I only appear on TV on a TV. I'm like, that's fucking cool. Like, this guy is probably my favorite character. That's like that. It gives the same energy of like people that. Back in the day, they're like, the camera's gonna steal my soul if you take a picture of me.
Yeah, that guy was dropping some absolutely like hard lines throughout the movie, like the television is the retina of the soul and like all crazy shit. Also, this movie is excellent for like just quotable one-liners. Like, oh, sorry, if I get a little closer to the mic, is that fine?
You're good now.
Yeah. Okay. The movie is really good for excellent one-liners that could be like tattoos, like Death to Videodrome, Long Live the New Flesh, Like that, Long Live the New Flesh. It's just, it sounds so awesome. Like that would be a great album name. Anyway, yeah, keep going, Neil.
But like outside of a lot of the like body horror moments, the alleged hallucinations, I don't know. I got kind of bored sometimes. You know, I was definitely checking my phone. I got up at one point to cook dinner. It was just like, to me, narratively, I just thought that, like, this seems like a movie that is based on something that's from, like, a H.P. Lovecraft collection of short stories, where, like, it's interesting in, like, a broader context that doesn't actually exist in this case.
Mm-hmm.
Where H.P. Lovecraft stories, like, they all exist in, like, the same universe, and they might reference each other a little bit, but they're, like, vignettes. And this seemed like a vignette in a larger story, but the larger story doesn't actually exist. There was a lot of, like, cool ideas as far as, like, sci-fi, almost, like, cyberpunk, like, early cyberpunk ideals, and, like, they were cool, but it doesn't really get into them. We kind of talked about this with, like, Blade Runner, where, you know, they're name-dropping things, and there's, like, cool ideas, but they never go too deeply into them.
Mm-hmm.
And I think generally we agreed that with Blade Runner, that was a good thing. And here, I felt like it needed a little more fleshing out.
Emphasis on the flesh.
Yeah, emphasis on flesh.
Yeah. New flesh.
But yeah, like, it wasn't a problem of performance. Again, I thought everybody was solid. I didn't recognize the singer from Blondie until you, so that was her, but.
Yeah, yep.
It didn't enthrall me.
Yeah. No, I totally understand where you're coming from. I think we feel the same way about this movie, where it's like, that there's nothing wrong with, like, the performances. James Wood is adequately cast as a, like, an intelligent but nervous masculine kind of character, but that's James Woods and everything. Debbie Harry is sexy, but that's Debbie Harry and literally everything, right? Like, that's her whole thing. And it's a feast of aesthetic, like pre-cyberpunk VHS Betamax imported from Japan kind of aesthetic. Like, this movie looks great on a frame by frame basis, but in terms of the key components that really make you care about characters and drive you through a movie and get you invested, things it's a little weak in terms of the actual, like, plotting. The only movie that I can really compare this to, I think, is Eraserhead, and I think Eraserhead is a lot better than Videodrome, but that's just my opinion. Anyway, Gideon, let's hear your overall thoughts.
Yeah, I would agree with a lot of what both of you guys already said. I do think it has some cool, that blend of, like, the sci-fi horror of just, like, consuming this weird, horrifying media and how it can consume you and change you and almost, like, turn you into a monster. And it did seem like, you know, maybe that would have been, like, prophetic at the time, but maybe it's also, like, I'm sure there was plenty of talk like that back in the 80s. I don't know. Yeah, I really liked all the actors. I don't think I was personally bored, but it's what, like, 90-something minutes?
Yeah, it's barely 90 minutes.
It did feel a bit of a longer 90 minutes, not as snappy as some movies might be, I guess. And I did feel like I got a little confused with the plot towards, like, the third act, I guess you could say.
Mm-hmm.
Or just got harder to follow with everything that was going on. But on the whole, yeah. I don't know. It was just interesting. It had a lot of interesting ideas and just, like, having a character like that, especially with a movie that's, what, 41 years old at this point.
Yeah.
But,
yeah.
I thought it was cool thinking about it from that perspective. Not my favorite. I don't know if I'm going to be a big Cronenberg fan myself, even just with not really being crazy about body horror, but it was cool in like a time capsule way, kind of to watch this. And I do agree with, I feel like the impact would have been greater watching it back in the day.
What were you guys' favorite body horror sequences in this movie? Was it the goo gun? Was it the stomach ussy? What do we got?
I think for me, I guess I'm torn. I think on a purely like body horror vibe, I think his like hand starting to fuse with a gun, like the screws like moving through his palm, and I thought that was really well done. But in a more narrative sense, I actually think like him sort of hallucinating, going into like Videodrome mode, and then whipping the TV that was once Blondie, but then is later Marsha.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that was probably one of the more interesting symbolic parts of the movie.
Yeah. Yeah, that part was definitely cool. The most iconic part being where like Debbie Harry's lips are blown up to the size of the TV and he's like falling into the TV. I mean, it's like such an iconic shot from this movie. But I would agree with you. To me, the strongest bit was watching like the screws go through his palm and everything, and the makeup is just like so good. And also when the CEO of what is it called, Spectacular Vision.
Yeah, that guy
gets shot and then starts turning into like mutating into a monster. That part was, I didn't really understand it, but I was like, okay, you know, I'm glad they like blew the rest of the budget on that one sequence. That was cool.
Was that like his tumor, you think?
Yeah, he was just like full of Videodrome tumors.
That's what Alyssa had said when we were watching it. Just like, it's almost like his tumor was like breaking through his whole body like that.
Yeah, what a weird place for the movie to end, by the way, like out on that boat in the dockyard. Did that strike anybody else as just being like a weirdly, like, I don't want to say like an irrelevant location, but it was just like, somebody made that choice to end it out in the dockyard. And I just thought that was so interesting for a movie that really had just taken place like inside the city and inside like really heavily urban environments. Go ahead, Neil.
I can explain. So this movie was made in Canada. And it shot in Toronto, so they had to end it in like a place that literally mutates humans, which is Lake Ontario.
Mm.
Like, you look at that water, it is not clean.
Oh yeah, I suppose so. Yeah, I knew David Cronenberg was Canadian, but I think he like, I was reading something about like he made all these movies when he was like evading taxes or something like that, or like he made them like all out of the country, out of the U.S., so he didn't have to like pay a bunch of taxes on the movie. I don't know. It was some weird like tax avoidance scheme.
That's crazy.
This was the first one he made where he got like any kind of studio budget.
Okay.
First like brand name movie kind
of. Okay. Yeah, that's interesting because my mom really likes the movie The Fly, which is also David Cronenberg and has a really young Jeff Goldblum in it. Maybe we should take a look. And I think Jeff Goldblum's actually naked in that movie. Maybe we should all take a look at that movie at some point.
That's crazy.
Yeah, I know. we get going with the Jeff Goldblum OC.
That's great.
That
came out 3 years later.
Okay. It was probably his next movie after this then. That particular effect of James Wood's stomach being open and him like reaching in like with the gun or whatever. Oh, the part that really made me laugh the hardest in this movie was when like Harlan reaches his hand inside the James Woods stomach and then somehow pulls off, like his hand is missing but he's got a hand grenade in place of it, and then he just fucking blows up. I laughed so goddamn hard.
I didn't realize like what I was looking at when he took his hand back out, like that it was an explosive or anything. Because did he put a grenade in there ever?
I don't remember him ever putting a grenade in there.
I almost wondered if it was like his fingers like curled back and like then just that thin bone. Like I didn't know what was going on.
I didn't understand what was happening until it exploded.
Yeah.
And even then I was like, what the hell just happened?
Yeah.
Another sequence I think probably my favorite single sequence of the movie is when he puts the giant VR helmet on. And the then he's just seeing, yeah, the virtual boy, and he's just seeing in like red and black, and it,
yeah,
that was something. Sick. Oh, it was just like the audio visual of that sequence, and like the music and the weird way that the graphics are rendered inside the helmet was just like so awesome. Even though that was exactly the point of the movie that things really started to go off the rails in terms of plot. And it was like, I'm in this for the ride at this point. To your guys' point, if the movie is barely 90 minutes long and we're all getting kind of like, Neil's maybe getting a little bit bored and checking his phone, and I'm kind of getting lost in the sauce a little bit, not a good sign for you as a filmmaker. If you can't hold my attention for 90 minutes, that's bad. I don't know. What else do we want to say about this? The shit that we didn't like in this movie?
I didn't like his Hitler poster he had hanging up. It was funny,
that
though.
That was weird.
But I was like, obviously this guy is into like edgy shit, you know, clearly.
Mm-hmm. Which one are you talking? I saw a little Hitler poster, but it was like Hitler in like a tutu doing ballet.
Yeah, I was like, is he at the Olympics? I didn't know exactly what he was doing.
I think it was meant to be like...
Oh, like mocking him or something?
Yeah, and also like, you know, the guy's an edge lord.
Right. Yeah. With the weird tapes.
Yeah. But I just felt like this movie was disjointed in a couple of ways, and I think on a certain level intentionally.
Mm-hmm.
But it just like it was like, okay, here's a cool idea, and we're just gonna touch on we're gonna move on to something else that may or may not be cool. I'm like, no. Focus on the other like. Give me one thing to focus on. I think the movie does suffer just from being, 40 years dated, like you mentioned, Sam.
Where
I think it's definitely like a sort of reaction to the Reagan Thatcher era of like moral conservatism. Which is fine, but again, yeah, like 40 years later, you know. I'm browsing Facebook and I'll see stuff that's like arguably more degenerate than what he's putting on television.
That was sort of my reaction as well. Like, if the overall, I mean, I don't think it's this simple, but I think a lot of people could read into this movie as being like, the message is TV is bad for you. And it's like, oh yeah, geez, you know, what a monstrous intelligent revelation, David Cronenberg. Like, maybe we shouldn't be watching so much television, you know, like that's, whatever.
Yeah, maybe it's predictive, and that's interesting in its own way. But just being so far removed, now it's like, okay.
I think he was right, though, that like one of the very first things Debbie Harry says in the movie is that like this. I'm not quoting her verbatim, but she's like, we live in an overstimulated society. Like, I crave the overstimulation and things like that.
Yeah.
And I, obviously super relate to that stuff. Like, Cronenberg could never have predicted the world that we now live in, which is going to get even worse with generative AI that knows exactly what you want to see and can create content for you spontaneously. But he did a good job of predicting that, like, this is a one-way track for humanity. Like, we're not putting the genie back in the bottle on wanting to be stimulated, you know? Like, for years, I've been trying to, like, put my phone down and just be more engaged with everything I'm doing, and I still can't. Like, I should be the person that really knows not to do it, and I still can't help myself from doing it just because I have monkey brain, and the technology has some level of control over me, you know? So I don't think he's wrong necessarily. I just don't think it strikes me as particularly fresh in 2024. But again, that's not really the movie's fault. So I don't know. I'm kind of split.
I do just have to wonder, like, if so, this was his like first big commercial movie. I think it flopped super hard. I think it was made for like just shy of $6 million $1980s, and which is like $19 million in today's money, and I think it made back like a third of its budget. But I have to wonder, like, who was this movie made for? Like,
I
mentioned in a race with a Eraserhead that I think it was made by David Lynch for David Lynch. This one seems to be meant to be more commercial, as far as like I'm trying to say something to other people, but I don't know, like, you know, like who in 1983 was like getting, oh my god, it's the new David Cronenberg film.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, you know, like whenever we're doing an 80s movie for the episode, I always ask like my parents, I always say like, hey, we're doing this movie. Have you guys heard of it? Neither of them had heard of Videodrome. None of the older guys at my work had heard of Videodrome. Like,
it's crazy.
None of them knew anything about it, even though my mom like had obviously seen The Fly on HBO in the late 80s and really liked it or whatever.
Wow.
So yeah, definitely under the radar. I mean, none of us had seen it. None of us even barely knew what it was about. So this is really a cult movie that ironically I think only became successful after probably like, becoming available for VHS rental.
I did wonder, actually, this was one thought that I had, was like, did somebody check this, did David Cronenberg write this script?
Yes.
I think it said written and directed by, yeah.
Yep.
So, I kind of wondered, what would this movie look like if it was, you know, same script, but directed by Paul Verhoeven?
It'd be a lot funnier, and it'd probably be more violent somehow.
Probably more badass.
I think that was like, the thought. I was like, I think this movie would be better if it was directed by Paul Verhoeven.
Yeah, I think there's a strong argument to be made there. I mean, that's a really interesting question. I think he would run with the subject matter.
It definitely reminded me of like an adaptation of a Philip K. Dick movie.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, it could fit right into Total Recall or Blade Runner or. Did Philip K. Dick write The Man in the High Castle?
I believe so.
Man of the High...
I don't know.
Let's see. Look it up. Yeah, Jesus, I'm good. There is. Somebody keep talking while I try to figure this out. Yeah, it is Philip K. Dick. Oh.
Nice.
God damn, that guy was on fire. I think he wrote the short story that became the inspiration for The Terminator as well.
Damn.
This is... Yeah, the dude just fucking killed it. I should say, this isn't related to Videodrome at all, but on the plane out to New York City, Grace and I watched the first Matrix. Oh, boy. Now that's a 5 out of 5 sci-fi movie right there.
That,
I don't know if you guys have
a first time watch for you.
No, I've seen the Matrix a gazillion times, but I'm always blown away by how much. And some people say that they've softened on the Matrix over time. I wouldn't say it's gotten better for me, but
Sam, just say that you've hardened on the Matrix.
I harden on the Matrix every time I watch that fucking movie, dude. Like when Morpheus is explaining the background of how the aliens took over humanity, and then he's like looking at the dystopian New York City skyline and he's like, "Welcome to the desert of the now." I'm like, incredible. Okay. Anyway, do we want to give our final ratings on Videodrome?
Yeah, we can do that.
Okay. I'm going to go ahead and settle on a 3. Last night I was at like a week 4. I think I've come down off that a little bit. I'm going to go ahead and give it a 3. Just a real middle of the road. Like, it's a specific review. If you're in it for the visuals and the aesthetic and the audio and the body horror, there's some stuff to like here, and it's short enough that you're going to be able to get to that stuff quickly and consume it and enjoy yourself. If you're looking to this for this movie for a strong central plot or characters or exceptional performances, you will not find it. But that's okay. You know, it doesn't. Not every movie needs to be necessarily just like that. So I liked it. I think its status in the Criterion Collection is maybe a little oversold. I think the social commentary was probably a little bit more applicable in 1982. But still, you know, I would recommend it for a very specific audience. Whoever.
I can go. Yeah, for me, I just watched it today before the podcast. I was fluctuating between a 2 and a 3. And I'm going to go with my heart and just give it a 2. I didn't really hate it. It's fine. Like, All the acting, I think, is pretty well done. I didn't really have any major gripes. It is an interesting, it's a very interesting cult movie to check out. If you're like a horror fan or a beginner horror fan, I think this is a great place to start for if you're, you know, trying to check out some body horror or just sci-fi horror and stuff like that. I definitely agree with what you said about just kind of the ideas and the music and some of the shots and stuff, and all the practical effects stuff is really awesome if you're a big fan of that. But ultimately, just not really for me or to my taste. I don't like hate it by any means, but it would be hard to recommend for most people, I'd say. But yeah, two.
Yeah, I was kind of in a similar spot to you, Gideon. I was fluctuating between a two and a three. I'm going to give it a really soft three. I think it's worth the one-time viewing just to, you know, see those special effects. And ultimately, like, there wasn't anything that's, like, offensively bad. Like, again, performances are all solid. The music's good. There's some interesting shots that aren't body horror. There's nothing that makes it, like, really bad. It's just, like, a little disjointed and just, eh. But it's not, like, awful. It's not a bad movie. It's just I didn't enjoy it as much as I guess I kind of hoped I would, and it didn't strangely enough, like, the body horror was, like, arguably the best part for me, because I could at least enjoy the craftsmanship. Like,
mm-hmm.
That's where it really stands out, is like, okay, like, even though I'm grossed out, I can appreciate it.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, otherwise it's just kind of milk toast in some ways, which is a weird thing to say about it. But
why do you guys think Eraserhead is better than this?
Erasure, you go ahead, Neil.
No, you go.
Eraserhead, it almost is like, with its visual style, it is so, like, it almost feels like narrative driven. Like, when I was talking about that shot in Eraserhead, and he's, like, just looking at his blanket or whatever, it feels like this, like, desert of, like, his emotions of everything he's going on. Like, it's crazy. Like, it has, like, I feel like its visual style mixed with the soundscape, it has such a, like, scratches up a certain part of your brain type of thing. Like, I meant to tell you, I forgot about this, but I was in KFC the other day for, like, the first time in years, and it was playing the most, like, there was, like, a wind tunnel or something in the lobby there that was, like, the most Eraserhead-ass sounding thing. And
yeah.
It was just out of world.
It sticks with you, and there are, like, otherworldly images in Videodrome, but the entire visual audio landscape of Eraserhead is, like, from another planet. And it was made 6 years earlier. It's a better looking movie. It's a better sounding movie. The effects are also, I wouldn't say as gruesome as the Videodrome effects, but they're pretty gruesome. How about you, Neil?
I think it comes down to focus. Like, I think, like, I Videodrome is, like, I think much simpler in a way, but again, I talked about how it just kind of felt disjointed. Things didn't feel totally fleshed out. Whereas Eraserhead has some, like, bizarre, like, truly bizarre things going on, like, that narratively don't make sense, but somehow they do. Just, like, it all just comes together in a, like, a really disconcerting way for me.
Yeah.
So, like, even though it's, I think, much more complex, it also, like, you know, everything's working together, whereas I feel like Videodrome is kind of pulling in different directions.
Yeah. To me, it's all about, like, the focus, right? Like, Eraserhead, even though it is audiovisually really awesome and has, like, great effects and a cool style, underneath all that sort of surface level stuff, there is a deeply personal story being told about, like, how David Lynch is afraid of the commitment of being a husband and a father, and how he can't handle it, and how he's, like, at the end of the movie giving it all up and throwing it away to go for the art life and just pursue his art, because he's like, he can't deal with it. And there's like a really personal like confession there, and it's a very clear message. Even though it's wrapped up in all this like weird imagery, and people are like, oh, you know, I don't know what that movie's so weird. I don't know what it's about. But it's like very, I think the intention of it is very clear, actually. Whereas like Videodrome is like trying to say so much about society that like the actual message, whatever it is, kind of gets lost in there at some point. And it's cool, and I still like it. It's just not as laser focused on this like really interesting personal self-expression, and it gets kind of caught up in like trying to be the greatest sci-fi metaphor ever, and trying to, I think it just tries to do too much, really. But still, you know, liked it. I just think that as hard as this movie is to compare to anything else, the only comparable movie I think is just like much better. But again, that's, maybe that isn't really saying much. I mean, most people agree David Lynch is like one of the great living American directors, and David Cronenberg isn't even American. He's Canadian, so he's automatically lesser than David Lynch by that end. So yeah, if anybody, does anybody have anything they would like to say about Videodrome aside from Long Live the New Flesh?
Yeah.
I guess the extent of my thoughts on it.
Yeah.
I think the last thing I want to say, I did really like the set design of the weird like torture room that was like with the red and like black bars at the bottom. Definitely just feels like if I'm gonna have a nightmare, it's like I'm gonna wake up in that room, you know. Like, yeah.
Yeah. I will say I don't think we gave enough credit to how sexy Debbie Harry is in this movie.
Yeah, incredible.
She's just awesome. And I mean, but that's, again, I think that's kind of like a testament to the casting director. They just like picked one of the hottest, you know, female singers from the 80s. So anyway, all right. Well, whose turn was it to go next week?
I think Neil or Alex.
Okay. Well, Alex isn't here, so.
I wasn't expecting to.
Okay. Well, how about you think about it and shoot us something in the chat? Okay, awesome. See you later, guys.
Later.